Well, if that's what you want. He rose, picked her up easily, and carried her across the encampment to their tent.
Garion,
she murmured drowsily, after he had gently drawn their blankets up around her shoulders.
Yes, dear. Please, don't wear your male shirt when you come to bed. It makes you smell like an old iron pot.
Tenedra's sleep that night was disturbed by strange dreams. She seemed to see people and places she had not seen, or even thought of, in years. She saw legionnaires guarding her father's palace, and Lord Morin, her father's chamberlain, hurrying down a marble corridor. Then she seemed to be at Riva, holding a long, incomprehensible conversation with Brand, the Riven warder, while Brand's blonde niece sat spinning flax by the window. Errol seemed unconcerned about the dagger hilt protruding from between her shoulder blades. Tenedra stirred, muttering to herself, and immediately began to dream again. She seemed then to be a Rehan in eastern Thrasnia. Casually, she plucked a dagger from the belt of Vela, the Nadrak dancer, and just as casually drove it to the hilt, into the belly of a black-bearded Ulfgar, the head of the bear cult. Ulfgar was speaking sneeringly to Belgarath as Tenedra sank the knife into him, and he did not even pay any attention to her as she slowly twisted the blade in his vitals. And then she was at Riva again, and she and Garion were sitting naked beside a sparkling forest pool while thousands of butterflies hovered over them. She traveled in her restless dream to the ancient city of Val-Alor in Kerech, and then went on to Bokdor for the funeral of King Rodar. And once again she saw the battlefield at Tul Mardu, and once more the face of her self-appointed protector, Bran's son, Olban. There was no coherence to the dream. She seemed to go from place to place without effort, moving through time and space looking for something, although she could not remember what it was she had lost. When she awoke the next morning, she was as tired as she had been the previous evening. Every movement was an effort, and she kept yawning. "What's the matter?" Garion asked her as they dressed. "Didn't you sleep well?"
"Not really,"
she replied.
"I kept having the strangest dreams."
"Do you want to talk about them? Sometimes that's the best way to put them to rest, so they don't keep coming back night after night."
"They didn't make any sense, Garion. They just kept jumping around. It was almost as if someone were moving me from place to place for some reason of her own."
"Her? Was this someone a woman?"
"Did I say her? I can't imagine why. I never saw this person."
Tenedra yawned again.
"I hope whoever it was got finished with it, though. I'd rather not go through another night like that."
And then she gave him a sly, sidelong glance through her eyelashes.
"There were some parts of the dream that were rather nice, though. Once we were sitting by that pool back at Riva. Do you want to know what we were doing?"
A slow blush crept up Garion's neck. No, Tenedra. I don't really think so." But she told him anyway, in great detail, until he finally fled from the tent. Her restless night increased the peculiar lassitude that had lain on her since they had left Kel, and she rode that morning in a half-doze that, try though she might, she could not seem to shake off. Garion spoke with her several times to warn her that she was allowing her horse to stray, and then, apparently, seeing that she just couldn't keep her eyes open, he took her reins from her hands and led her horse. About mid-morning, Beldon rejoined them.
"I think you'd better take cover," he tersely told Belgarath. "There's a Darshevan patrol coming along this trail."
"Are they searching for us?"
"Who knows? If they are, they're not being very serious about it. Go back into the woods for a couple of hundred yards and let them ride on by. I'll keep an eye on them and let you know when they've passed."
"All right."
Belgarath turned aside from the trail and led the rest of them back into the concealment of the forest. They dismounted and waited tensely. Soon they heard the jingling of the soldiers' equipment as they rode along the forest trail at a trot. Even in this potentially dangerous situation, Cynedra simply could not keep her eyes open. Dimly she could hear the whispered conversations of the others until she finally dozed off again. And then she came awake, or at least partially so. She was walking alone through the forest, her mind all bemused. She knew that she should be alarmed at being separated from the others, but oddly, she was not. She walked on, not so much going anywhere in particular as following some sort of subtle summoning. Then at last she reached a grassy clearing and saw a tall blonde girl standing among the wildflowers and holding a blanket-wrapped bundle in her arms. The girl's blonde braids were coiled at her temples, and her complexion was like new milk. It was Bran's niece, Errol.
"Good morning, Your Majesty,"
she greeted the Queen of Riva.
"I've been waiting for you."
Something deep in Cynedra's mind tried to scream at her that this was wrong, that the Tall Raven girl could not possibly be here. But Cynedra could not remember why, and the moment passed.
"Good morning, Errol,"
she said to her dear friend.
"What on earth are you doing here?" "I came to help you, Cynedra. Look at what I found."
She turned back the corner of the blanket to reveal a tiny face.
"My baby!"
Cynedra exclaimed, almost overcome with joy. She ran forward, her arms extended hungrily, and took the sleeping infant from her friend and held him to her body, her cheek pressed against his soft curls.
"How did you possibly find him?"
she asked Errol.
"We've been looking for him for the longest time now."
"I was traveling alone through this forest,"
Errol replied,
"and I thought I smelled the smoke of a campfire. I went to investigate, and I found a tent set up beside a little stream. I looked inside the tent, and there was Prince Garen. There was no one else around, so I picked him up and came looking for you."
Cynedra's mind was still trying to scream at her, but she was too deliriously happy to pay any attention. She held her baby, rocking back and forth and crooning to him.
"Where is King Belgarion?"
Errol asked.
"Back there someplace,"
Cynedra gestured vaguely.
"You should go to him and let him know that his son is safe."
"Yes, he'll be very happy."
"I have something that I really have to attend to, Cynedra,"
Errol said.
"Do you think you will be able to find your way back alone?"
"Oh, I'm sure I could. But couldn't you come along? His Majesty is sure to want to reward you for restoring our son to us."
Errol smiled.
"The happiness on your face is all the reward I need, and this matter I must take care of is extremely important. I may be able to join you later, however. Which way will you be traveling?"
"South, I think,"
Cynedra replied.
"We have to get to the seacoast."
"Oh?"
"Yes, we're going to an island, Perivore, I think the name is."
"There's supposed to be a meeting of some kind very soon, isn't there? Is Perivore the place where it's going to happen?"
"Oh, no,"
Cynedra laughed, still cuddling her baby.
"We are just going to Perivore to get some more information about it. We will be going on from there."
"I may not be able to join you at Perivore,"
Errol said, frowning slightly.
"Perhaps you could tell me where the meeting is supposed to take place. I am sure I'll be able to meet you there."
Let me see,"
Cynedra pondered.
"What did they call it? Oh, now I remember. It is someplace that's called Corim."
"Corim?"
Errol exclaimed in astonishment.
"Yes. Belgarath seemed dreadfully upset when he first found out about it. But Sir Aris told him that everything would be all right. That is why we have to go to Perivore. Sir Aris says that there is something there that will make everything clear. It seems to me that she said something about a chart or something."
She laughed a bit giddily.
To be honest with you, Errol, I have been so sleepy for the last few days that I can barely keep track of what the people around me are saying.
Of course,
Errol said absently, her face creased in thought.
Why would Perivore be the key?
She mused to herself.
What could possibly be there to explain an absurdity? Are you absolutely certain the word was Corim? Perhaps you misunderstood.
That was the way I heard it, Errol. I didn't read it for myself, but Belgarath and Belden kept talking about the high places of Corim, which are no more. And isn't the meeting supposed to be at the place which is no more? I mean, it does sort of fit together, doesn't it?
Yes,
Errol replied, frowning strangely.
Now that I think about it, it does.
Then she straightened, smoothing her gown.
I'll have to leave you now, Sinetra. Take your baby back to your husband. Give him my regards.
Her eyes seemed to glint in the sunlight.
Give my best to Polgara as well, she added.
There seemed to be something slightly malicious in the way she said it. She turned then and walked away, crossing the flowery meadow toward the dark edge of the forest.
Goodbye, Errol,
Sinedra called after her.
Thank you so much for finding my baby.
Errol neither turned nor answered. Geryon was frantic. When he first discovered that his wife was missing, he leaped into his saddle and rode Kretchen off into the forest at a gallop. He had gone 300 yards before Belgarath finally caught up with him.
Geryon, stop, the old man shouted.
But grandfather, Geryon shouted back, I have got to find Sinedra.
Where do you plan to start looking? Or are you just going to ride around in circles, trusting to luck?
But
use your head, boy. We have another way that's much faster. You know what she smells like, don't you?
Well, of course, but
then we have to use our noses. Get down off of that horse and send him back. We'll change form and follow her trail. It is faster and a great deal more certain.
Geryon felt suddenly very foolish.
I wasn't thinking, I guess, he confessed.
I did not think you were. Get rid of that horse.
Geryon slid down and slapped Kretchen sharply on the rump. The big gray bolted back toward where the others were still concealed.
What on earth was she thinking of?
Geryon fumed.
I'm not sure if she was, Belgarath grunted. She has been acting strangely for the past few days. Let's get on with this. The quicker we find her, the quicker we can get her back to the others. Your aunt can get to the bottom of this.
The old man was already blurring into the shape of the huge silver wolf.
You lead, he growled at Geryon. Her scent is more familiar to you.
Geryon changed and cast back and forth until his nose caught Sinedra's familiar fragrance.
She went this way.
He cast his thought to Belgarath.
How fresh is the trail? The old wolf asked.
It can't be much more than a half hour old,
Geryon replied, bunching himself to run.
Good. Let's go find her.
And the two of them ran smoothly through the woods, their noses to the ground in the manner of hunting wolves. They found her after about a quarter of an hour. She was coming happily back through the forest, crooning softly to a bundle she was carrying tenderly in her arms.
Don't startle her, Belgarath warned. There is something very wrong here. Just go along with anything she tells you.
The two of them shimmered and changed. Sinedra gave a little cry of delight when she saw them.
Oh, Geryon,
she exclaimed, running toward them.
Look, Errol found our baby.
Errol? But Errol's...
Just let it lie, Belgarath snapped under his breath. Don't send her into hysterics.
Why... that's wonderful, Sinedra,
Geryon said, trying to make it sound natural.
It's been so long,
Sinedra said, her eyes brimming with tears.
And he looks just the same as he did before. Look, Geryon, isn't he beautiful?
She turned back the blanket. and Geryon saw that what she was holding so tenderly was not a baby, but a bundle of rags. Part 2. Perivor. Chapter 9. Eternal Salmisra had dispensed with the services of Addis, her chief eunuch, that morning. Stunned into forgetfulness by a massive dose of one of his favorite drugs, Addis had shambled into the throne room to make his daily report. When he had come to within a dozen feet of the dais, Salmisra had detected from his rank odor that he had disobeyed her command that he never enter her presence unbathed. Cold-eyed, she had watched the eunuch prostrate himself on the marble floor before the throne to deliver his report in a slurred voice. The report had never been finished. At a sibilant command from the Serpent Queen, a small green snake had emerged from beneath the divan-like throne, purring quietly, and Addis had received a suitable reward for his disobedience. And now, Eternal Salmisra, coiled pensively on her throne, idly contemplating her reflection in the mirror. The troublesome business of selecting a new chief eunuch still lay before her, and she was not really in the mood for it. She decided finally to forego the chore for a time to give the palace eunuchs the opportunity to scramble for the position. That scramble usually resulted in a number of fatalities, and there were really too many eunuchs in the palace anyway. From under the throne, there was an irritated grumbling. Her pet green snake was obviously distressed about something.
"What is it, Isa?"
she asked him.
"Can't you have them washed before you ask me to bite them, Salmisra?"
Isa replied plaintively.
"You might have at least warned me what to expect."
Although Isa and Salmisra were of different species, their languages were, to some degree, compatible.
"I'm sorry, Isa. It was inconsiderate of me, I suppose."
In rather sharp contrast to her dealings with humans, whom she held more or less in general contempt, the Serpent Queen was unfailingly polite to other reptiles, particularly the venomous ones. This is considered the course of wisdom in the world of snakes.
"It was not entirely your fault, Salmisra."
Isa was also a snake, and he was also very polite.
"I just wish there was some way to get the taste out of my mouth."
"I could send for a saucer of milk. That might help."
"Thank you, Salmisra, but the taste of him might curdle it. What I'd really like is a nice fat mouse, alive, preferably." "I'll see to it at once, Isa."
She turned her triangular face around on her slender neck.
"You,"
she hissed to one of the chorus of eunuchs, kneeling in adoration at one side of the throne.
"Go catch a mouse. My little green friend is hungry."
"At once, divine Salmisra,"
the eunuch replied obsequiously. He jumped to his feet and backed toward the door, genuflecting at every other step.
"Thank you, Salmisra,"
Isa purred.
"Humans are such trivial things, aren't they?"
"They respond only to fear,"
she agreed.
"And to lust."
"That raises a point,"
Isa noted.
"Have you had time to consider the request I made the other day?"
"I have some people looking,"
she assured him.
"But your species is very rare, you know, and finding a female for you might take some time."
"I can wait, if necessary, Salmisra,"
he purred.
"We are all very patient.
patient.
He paused.
I'm not trying to be offensive, but if you hadn't chased Zadi away, you wouldn't have to take the trouble. His little snake and I were on very good terms.
I noticed that on occasion. You might even be a father by now.
The green snake slid his head out from under the throne and regarded her. Like all snakes of his kind, he had a bright red stripe down his green back.
What's a father?
He asked in a dull and curious tone.
It's a difficult concept,
she replied.
Humans make much of it, for some reason. Does any real creature care about the perverse peculiarities of humans?
I certainly don't. At least, not anymore.
You were always a serpent at heart, Salmisra. Why, thank you, Asa,
she said in a pleased hiss. She paused, her restless coils rubbing dryly against each other.
I must select a new chief eunuch, she mused. It's a bothersome thing. Why trouble yourself? Select one at random. Humans are all alike, after all. Most of them, yes. I've been attempting to locate Zadi, however. I would like to persuade him to come back to Stithi's Tor. That one is different,
Isa agreed.
One might almost believe that he is somewhat akin to us.
He does have certain reptilian qualities, doesn't he?
He's a thief and a scoundrel, but he still managed the palace better than anyone else has ever been able to. If I hadn't been molting when he fell into disgrace, I might have forgiven him. Shedding one's skin is always a trying procedure.
Isa agreed.
If you don't mind a bit of advice, Salmisra, you should probably make the humans stay away from you at those times.
I need a few of them around me. If nothing else, it gives me someone to bite.
Stick to mice, he advised. They taste better, and at least they can be swallowed.
If I can persuade Zadi to return, it may just solve both our problems,
she hissed dryly.
I'll have someone to run the palace without bothering me, and you will get your little playmate back.
Interesting notion, Salmisra.
He looked around.
Is that human you sent out to fetch my mouse, raising it from infancy?
He asked. Yarblek and Vela slipped into Yar-Nadrak late one snowy evening, just before the gates were closed for the night. Vela had left her lavender satin gowns at Bokdor and had reverted to her traditional tight leather garb. Because it was winter, she wore in addition a sable coat that would have cost a fortune in Tolhanath.
Why does this place always smell so bad?
She asked her owner as they rode through snow-clogged streets toward the riverfront.
Probably because Strasta let the contract for the sewer system out to one of his cousins.
Yarblek shrugged, pulling the collar of his shabby felt coat up around his neck.
The citizens paid a great deal in taxes for the system. But Rosta's cousin turned out to be a better embezzler than he was an engineer. I think it runs in the family. Thrasta even embezzles from his own treasury.
Isn't that sort of absurd?
We have an absurd sort of king, Vela.
I thought the palace was over that way.
She pointed toward the center of town.
Thrasta won't be in the palace at this time of night, Yarblick told her. He gets lonesome when the sun goes down. He usually goes out looking for companionship.
He could be anywhere, then.
Oh, I doubt it. There are only a few places in Yarnadrak where he's welcome after dark. Our king is not widely loved.
Yarblick pointed up a littered alley.
Let's go this way. We'll stop by the office of our factor and get you some suitable clothing.
What's wrong with what I'm wearing?
Sable attracts attention in the part of town we're going to visit, Vela. We are trying to be inconspicuous.
The office in Yarnadrak, of Silk and Yarblick's far-flung commercial empire, was in a loft over a cavernous warehouse filled with bales of furs and deep-piled Malorian carpets. The factor was a squinty-eyed Nadrak named Zelmit, who was probably almost as untrustworthy as he looked. Vela had never really liked him, and she customarily loosened her daggers in their sheaths whenever she came into his presence, making very sure that he saw her doing so to be certain that there would be no misunderstandings. Technically, of course, Vela was one of Yarblick's possessions, and Zelmet had a reputation for making rather free with things that belonged to his employer.
"How's business?"
Yarblick asked as he and Vela entered the cluttered little office.
"We're getting by," Zelmet said in a rasping voice.
"Specifics, Zelmet," Yarblick said brusquely. "Generalities make my teeth itch."
"We found a way to bypass Bokhtor and evade Drasnian customs."
"Well, that's useful."
"It takes a bit longer, but we can get our furs to Tolhanath without paying Drasnian duties. Our profits in the fur market are up by 60%.
Yarblick beamed.
"If Silk ever comes back through here, I don't think you really need to tell him about it," he cautioned. "Sometimes he breaks out in a rash of patriotism, and Porin is his aunt, after all."
"I wasn't really thinking of telling him. We still have to carry the Malorian carpets through Drasnia, though. The best market for those is still the Great Fair in Central Arendia, and we cannot pay anybody enough to get him to freight them across Ugaland."
He frowned.
"Someone is cutting the prices on us, though. Until we can find out what's going on, it might not be a bad idea to curtail our imports."
"Did you manage to sell off those gemstones I brought back from Meloria?"
"Naturally. We smuggled them out and sold them here and there on our way south."
"Good. It always depresses the market when you show up in one place with a bushel basket full of them. Do you know if Drosta's in the usual place tonight?"
Zelmit nodded.
"He went up there just before sundown."
"Vera's going to need a sort of nondescript cloak," Yarblick said then.
Zelmit squinted at the girl. Vela opened her fur coat and put her hands on the hilts of her daggers.
"Why don't you go ahead and try it now, Zelmit? Let's get it over with."
"I wasn't really planning anything, Vela," he said innocently. "I was just sizing you up, that's all."
"I noticed," she said dryly. "Did that cut on your shoulder ever heal?"
"It aches a little in damp weather," he complained.
"You should have kept your hands to yourself."
"I think I've got an old cloak that will fit you. It is a little shabby, though."
So much the better," Yarblick said. "We're going to the One-Eyed Dog, and we'd like to sort of blend in."
Vela removed her sable and laid it across a chair.
"Don't lose track of this, Zelmet," she warned. "I am fond of it, and I am sure we'd both hate what would happen if it accidentally wound up on a caravan bound for Tolhanath."
"You don't have to threaten him, Vela," Yarblick said mildly.
That was not a threat, Yarblick. I just wanted to be sure that Zelmet and I understood each other.
I'll get that cloak, Zelmet offered.
Do that.
The cloak was not so much shabby as it was tattered, and it smelled as if it had never been washed. Vella pulled it on over her shoulders with some reluctance.
Put the hood up, Yarblick told her.
I'll have to wash my hair if I do.
So?
Do you know how long it takes hair like mine to dry in the wintertime?
Just do it, Vella. Why do you always argue with me?
It's a matter of principle.
He sighed mournfully.
Take care of our horses, he told Zelmet. We'll walk the rest of the way.
And then he led Vella out of the office. When they reached the street, he took a length of clinking chain with a leather collar on one end out of a side pocket of his overcoat.
Put this on, he told her.
I haven't worn a chain or collar in years, she said.
It's for your own protection, Vella, he said wearily. We're going into a very rough part of town, and the one-eyed dog is the roughest place down there. If you're chained, nobody will bother you, unless he wants to fight with me. If you are loose, some of the men in the tavern might misunderstand.
That's what my daggers are for, Yarblick.
Please, Vella. Oddly enough, I sort of like you, and I don't want you getting hurt.
Affection, Yarblick?
She laughed.
I thought the only thing you really liked was money.
Well, I'm not a complete scoundrel, Vella.
You'll do until the real thing comes along, she said,
fastening the collar around her neck.
As a matter of fact, they sort of like you, too.
His eyes widened, and he grinned.
Not that much, though,
she added. The One-Eyed Dog was perhaps the foulest tavern Vella had ever entered, and Vella had been in a large number of low dives and shabby taverns in her life. Since the age of 12, she had always relied on her daggers to ward off unwanted attentions. Although she had seldom been obliged to kill anyone, except for a few enthusiasts, she had nonetheless established a reputation for being a girl no sensible man would attempt. Sometimes that rankled a bit, though, since there were times when Vella might have welcomed an attempt. A nick or two in some unimportant places upon an ardent admirer would sustain her honor, and then, well, who knows?
Don't drink any of the beer here, Yarblick cautioned as they entered. The vat is open. There are usually a few drowned rats floating around in it.
He wrapped her chain around his hand. Vella looked around.
This is really a revolting place, Yarblick.
You've been spending too much time with Porin, he said. You're starting to get delicate.
How would you like to have me gut you?
She offered.
That's my girl, he grinned. Let's go upstairs.
What's up there?
The girls. Drosta doesn't come here for rat-flavored beer.
That's disgusting, you know.
You've never met Drosta, have you? Disgusting only begins to describe him. He even turns my stomach.
Are you planning to just walk in on him? Aren't you going to snoop around a bit first?
You've been in Thrasnia too long, he replied,
as they started up the steps.
Drosta and I know each other. He knows better than to try to lie to me. I'll get to the bottom of this right away. Then we can get out of this stinking town.
I think you're starting to get delicate as well.
There was a door at the end of the hall, and a pair of Nadrak soldiers standing at either side of it proclaimed by their presence that King Drosta Lektun was inside.
How many so far?
Yarblick asked them, as he and Vella stopped in front of the door.
Three, isn't it?
One of the soldiers asked the other.
Nay, let's count.
The other soldier shrugged.
They all look the same to me.
Three, four, I forget. Is he busy right now?
Yarblick asked.
He's resting.
He must be getting old. He never used to have to rest after only three.
Do you want to tell him I'm here? I've got a business proposition for him.
Yarblick suggestively shook Vela's chain. One of the soldiers eyed Vela up and down.
She might be able to wake him up at that, he leered.
And I can put him back to sleep just as fast,
Vela said, opening her shabby cloak to reveal her daggers.
You're one of those wild women from up in the forest, aren't you?
The other soldier asked.
We really shouldn't let you in there with him, with those daggers.
Would you like to try to take them away from me?
Not me, girl, he replied prudently.
Good. Resharpening a dagger is very tedious, and I've been hitting bone a great deal lately.
The other soldier opened the door.
It's that Yarblick fellow again, your majesty, he said. He's got a girl he wants to sell you.
I just bought three,
a shrill voice replied with an obscene giggle.
Not like this one, your majesty.
It's so nice to be appreciated,
Vela murmured. The soldier grinned at her.
Yarblick, get in here,
King Drosta's high-pitched voice commanded.
Right away, your majesty. Come along, Vela.
Yarblick tugged on her chain and led her into the room. Drosta Lakhtun, king of Garagnadrak, lay half-dressed on a rumpled bed. He was, by far, the ugliest man Vela had ever seen. Even the hunchbacked dwarf Belden was handsome by comparison. He was scrawny, he had bulging eyes, his face was pockmarked and his beard scraggly.
You idiot,
he snapped at Yarblick.
Yarnadrak is overrun with Malorian agents. They know that you're Prince Keldar's partner and that you practically live in Porin's palace.
Nobody saw me, Drosta, Yarblick said. Even if they did, I've got a perfectly legitimate reason to be here.
He shook Vela's chain.
Do you really want to sell her?
Drosta said, eyeing the girl.
Hardly. But we can tell anybody curious about it that we could not agree on a price.
Why are you really here, then?
Porin's a little curious about your activities. Javelin's got some spies in your palace. But you're sneaky enough to hide what you're doing from them. I thought I'd save some time and come right to the source.
What makes you think I've been up to something?
You usually are.
Drosta laughed shrilly.
It's true, I suppose. But why should I tell you?
Because if you don't, I'll set up camp in the palace, and the Malorians will think you're crossing them.
That's blackmail, Yarblick,
Drosta accused.
Some people call it that, yes.
Drosta sighed.
All right, Yarblick. But this is for Porin's ears only, and I don't want you and Silk taking advantage of it. I've been trying to mend my fences with Zakath. Oh, he's very angry when I switch sides at Tolmardo. It's only a question of time until he subdues all of Tolmurgos. And I don't want him to get the idea of coming north looking for me. I've been negotiating with Braedor, the chief of his Bureau of Eternal Affairs, and we've almost reached an accommodation. I get to keep my skin if I allow Braedor's agents to pass through Garagnadrak to infiltrate the west. Zakath's pragmatic enough to forego the pleasure of having me skinned alive, if I'm useful to him.
Yarblick looked at him skeptically.
All right, Drosta. What else? That's hardly enough to keep Zakath from peeling you like an apple.
Sometimes you're too smart for your own good, Yarblick.
Give Drosta. I don't want to have to spend the next month here in Yarnadrak being conspicuous.
Drosta gave up.
I've cut the import duties on Malorian carpets. Zakath needs tax revenue to continue the war in Tolmurgos. If I cut the duties, Malorian merchants can undersell you and Silk in the marketplaces to the west. The whole plan is to make myself so indispensable to His Imperial Majesty that he will leave me alone.
I was wondering why our profits in carpets have been falling off,
Yarblick mused.
That's all? He asked.
I swear it is, Yarblick.
Your oaths tend to be a little worthless, my king.
Drosta had been looking at Vela appreciatively.
Are you absolutely positive you don't want to sell this girl?
He asked.
You could not really afford me, Your Majesty,
Vella told him.
And sooner or later your appetite would get the better of you. I would have to take steps at that point.
You wouldn't actually draw a knife on your own king, would you?
Try me.
Oh, one other thing, Drosta, Yarblick added. From now on, Silk and I will be paying the same import duties you are charging the Malorians.
Drosta's eyes bulged even more.
That's out of the question,
he almost screamed.
What if Braedor found out about it?
We just have to make sure he doesn't then, won't we? That's my price for keeping my mouth shut. If you don't cut those fees, I'll just have to let it be known that you have. You'll stop being so indispensable to Zakath at that point, won't you?
You are robbing me, Yarblick.
Business is business, Drosta, Yarblick said blandly.
King Anheg of Kerik had journeyed to Tol Hanoth to confer with Emperor Varana. When he had been admitted to the imperial apartments, he got right to the point.
We've got a problem, Varana, he said.
Oh.
You know my cousin, the Earl of Trelheim?
Barak?
Of course.
He hasn't been seen for quite some time. He's off with that oversized ship of his, and he's got some friends with him.
It's a free ocean, I suppose.
Who are these friends?
Kohag's son, Hethar, that Mimbrate Mandurallan, and Leldoran the Asturian. He also has his own son, Unrak, along, and the Ulgo fanatic Relg.
Varana frowned. That's a dangerous group, he noted.
I couldn't agree more. Sort of like a natural disaster looking for a place to happen.
And the ideas about what they are doing?
If I knew which way they were going, I could make a few guesses.
There was a polite tap on the door.
There's a Kerik out here, Your Imperial Majesty,
one of the guards outside the door announced.
He's a sailor, I think, and he says he needs to talk with King Anheg.
Send him in, the Emperor instructed.
It was Graldik, and he was slightly drunk.
I think I showed you problem, Anheg. And after I dropped you off on that pier, I wandered around on the docks for a while to see what kind of information I could pick up.
In taverns, I see.
You don't find sailors in tea rooms. Anyway, I came across the captain of a Tol Nedran merchantman. He'd picked up a cargo of Malorian goods, and he was coming south across the Sea of the East toward the southern end of Tol Murgos.
That's very interesting, but I don't quite see the point.
He saw a ship, and when I described Seabird to him, he agreed that it had been the ship he saw.
Oh, that's a start, anyway. Where is Barak going?
Where else? Meloria, of course.
After about a week's voyage, the Seabird made port at Dal Zerba, on the southwest coast of the Malorian continent. Barak asked a few questions, and then led his friends to the offices of Silk's factor in the port city. The factor was a very thin man, not so much undernourished as he was emaciated.
"We're trying to locate Prince Keldar," Barak rumbled to him. "It's a matter of some urgency, and we'd appreciate any information you might be able to give us as to his whereabouts."
The factor frowned.
"The last I heard was that he was in Melstein, on the other side of the continent. But that was over a month ago, and Prince Keldar moves around a great deal."
That is Silk, all right,
Hetar murmured.
"Do you have any guesses about where he might have gone from Melstein?"
Barak asked.
"This office is fairly new," the factor said, "and I'm sort of at the tail end of the route. Of any couriers?"
He made a sour face.
"The factor, up at Delfinda, was a bit put out when Keldar and Yarblick set up this office. I guess he felt that I might be in competition with him. Sometimes he forgets to pass things on to me. His office has been well established for some time, so the couriers always stop there. If anybody in this part of Delacia knows anything about Keldar's location, he would.
All right. Where's Starfinda, then?
Upriver, about 40 leagues.
Thanks for the help, friend. Do you happen to have a map of this part of Meloria?
I believe I could find one for you. Yes.
I'd appreciate it. We're not familiar with this part of the world.
So we go upriver, Hetar said, when Silk's factor was out of the room looking for the map.
If it's the only place where we can find out where Garion and the others are, we'll have to, Barak replied.
The current in the Finda River was sluggish, and the oarsmen made good time as they rowed upstream. They reached the river town late the following day, and went immediately to Silk's offices there. The factor here was almost the reverse of the man in Dalzerba. He was bulky, more than fat, and he had huge meaty hands and a florid face. He was not particularly cooperative.
How do I know you're the prince's friends?
He demanded suspiciously.
I'm not going to reveal his location to complete strangers.
Are you trying to be difficult? Barak asked.
The factor looked at the big red-bearded man and swallowed hard.
No. But sometimes the prince wants his whereabouts kept secret.
Probably when he is planning to steal something, Hetar added.
Steal?
The factor objected in a shocked voice.
The prince is a respectable businessman.
He is also a liar, a cheat, a thief, and a spy, Hetar told him. Now, where is he? We had heard that he had been in Melsine a while back. Where did he go from there?
Can you describe him?
The factor countered.
Short, Hetar replied. Sort of thin. He's got a face like a rat, and a long pointed nose. He's got a clever mouth, and he thinks he is funny.
That's a fair description of Prince Keldar,
the factor conceded.
We have heard that our friend standeth in a certain amount of danger, Mandarallan said. We have sailed many leagues to offer our assistance.
I was sort of wondering why most of you were wearing armor. All right. The last I heard was that he was bound for a place called Kel.
Show me, Barak said, unfolding his map.
It's over here. The factor said.
Is that river navigable?
As far north as Beleza.
Good. We can sail around the southern end of the continent and go up that river. How far back from the main channel is this Kel place?
Only or so from the east bank. It's at the very foot of the big mountain. I'd be careful, though. Kel's got the very peculiar reputation. The seers live there. They don't particularly welcome strangers.
We'll have to chance it, Barak said. Thanks for your help, friend. We'll give Keldar your regards when we catch up with him.
They set out downriver the following morning. There was enough of a breeze so that the sails were able to aid the oarsmen, and they made excellent time. It was shortly before noon when they heard a number of cracking detonations coming from somewhere just ahead.
Thanks, we will encounter a storm ere long, Mandarallan said.
Barak frowned.
The sky's perfectly clear, Mandarallan, he disagreed. And that doesn't sound exactly right for thunder.
He raised his voice.
Ship the oars and lower the sail,
he commanded his sailors, swinging his tiller over sharply so that Seabird coasted to the bank. Hetar, Relg, and Laldaran came up from below.
Why are we stopping? Hetar asked.
There's something peculiar going on just up ahead, Barak replied. I think we'd better go have a look before we blunder into anything.
You want me to get the horses?
I don't think so. It's not very far, and men on horseback are
kind of conspicuous.
You are starting to sound like Silk.
We've been together for quite a while. Unrak, he shouted to his son, who had been riding in the bow. We're going to go see what that noise is all about. You are in charge here until we get back.
But father, the red-haired boy protested.
That's an order, Unrak, Barak thundered.
Yes, sir, Unrak sounded slightly sullen.
The seabird swung slowly around in the current and bumped gently against the brush-covered riverbank. Barak and the others jumped from the rail to the bank and started cautiously inland. There were more of those strange detonations that did not sound exactly like thunder.
Whatever it is coming from just up ahead, Hetar said quietly.
Let's stay out of sight until we find out what's going on, Barak said. We've heard that kind of sound before, at Rachtul, when Belgoroth and Tukchik were fighting.
Sorcerers, thinkest thou? Mandarallan suggested.
I'm not positive, but I'm beginning to have some strong suspicions in that direction. I think we'd better stay undercover until we can see just who or what is out there.
They crept to the edge of a clump of scrubby trees and looked out at an open field. A number of black-robed figures lay smoking on the turf. Others huddled fearfully near the edge of the field.
Margos?
Hethar sounded startled.
Methinks not, my lord, Mandarallan said. If thou wilt look closely, thou wilt see that the hoods of their cloaks are lined in diverse colors, and those colors do not indicate rank among the Grolems. Thou wert wise, my lord Trelheim, to advise caution.
What's making them smoke like that?
Lodoran whispered nervously, fingering his bow. As if in answer to his question, a black-robed and hooded figure rose at the top of a knoll and gestured almost contemptuously. A ball of incandescent fire seemed to leap from the figure's hand, sizzled across the open field, and struck one of the frightened Grolems full in the chest with another of those cracking detonations. The Grolem shrieked and, clutching at his chest, fell to the earth.
I guess none explains the noise, Rogue observed.
Barak, Hetar said quietly. That one, on top of the knoll, is a woman.
Are you sure?
I have got very good eyes, Barak, and I can tell the difference between a man and a woman.
Well, so can I, but not when they're all wrapped up in cloaks like that.
Look at her elbows. The next time she raises her arms. Women's elbows are hinged differently from ours. Adara says it has to do with gerging babies.
Did you fear to come alone, Agachak?
The woman atop the little hill demanded with contempt. Then she flicked another fireball, and another Grolem crumpled to the ground.
I fear nothing, Zandramas.
A hollow voice came from the trees at the edge of the field.
Now we know who they are, Hetar said. But why are they fighting?
Zandra Moss is a woman?
Laldoran asked in amazement. Hetar nodded.
Queen Porin found out about it some time back. She sent word to the Eron kings, and Kohag told me.
Zandra Moss almost casually felled the three remaining Grolems.
Well, Agachak,
she said,
will you come out of hiding now, or must I come and find you?
A tall, cadaverous-looking Grolem stepped out of the trees.
Your fire will have no effect on me, Zandramas, he said, advancing toward the hooded woman.
I wasn't thinking of fire, Agachak,
she almost purred.
This will be your fate.
She suddenly seemed to blur and shimmer, and then standing in the place she had occupied was an enormous, hideous beast. It had a long, snake-like neck and huge bat wings.
Baylor, Barak swore. She just turned into a dragon.
The dragon spread her wings and flapped into the air. The cadaverous Grolem shrank back, then raised both arms. There was a shocking sound, and the dragon was suddenly encased in a sheet of green fire. The voice that came thundering from the dragon's mouth was still the voice of Xandoramas.
"You should have paid more attention to your studies, Agatjak, if you had. You would have known that Torak made dragons immune to sorcery."
The dragon hovered over the now terrified Grolem.
"Incidentally, Agatjak," she said, "you will be happy to know that Irvan is dead. Give him my regards when you see him."
And then she struck, sinking her talons into Agachak's chest. He shrieked once before a sudden billow of sooty fire burst from the dragon's mouth and engulfed his face. And then the dragon bit his head off. Lulduran made a retching sound.
"Great Kamdar,"
he gasped in a revolted voice.
"She's eating him."
There was a horrid crunching sound as the dragon continued her ghastly feast. Then, at last, with a shrill scream of triumph, she spread her huge wings and flew off to the east.
"Is it safe to come out now?"
a shaking voice asked from nearby.
"You had better," Beric said ominously, drawing his sword.
It was a Tull. He was young, with muddy-colored hair and a slack-lipped mouth.
"What is a Tull doing in Meloria?"
Lulduran asked the stranger.
"Agutjak brought me,"
the Tull replied, trembling violently.
"What's your name?" Relg asked him.
"I'm Natal, king of Mishrak Ak-Tull. Agutjak said he'd make me over king of Angarak if I'd help him with something he had to do here. Please, don't leave me alone."
Tears were streaming down his face. Barak looked at his companions. They all had expressions of pity on their faces.
"Oh, all right," he said grudgingly. "Come along, I guess."
Chapter 10.
"What's the matter with her, Aunt Paul?"
Geryon was looking at Zenedra, who sat crooning over her blanket-wrapped bundle of rags.
"That's what I need to find out," Polgara said. "Tzadi, I need some oret."
"Is that really wise, Lady Polgara?" the eunuch asked. "In her present condition,"
he spread his thin-fingered hands suggestively.
"If there's any danger, Aunt Paul,"
Geryon began.
"Oret is relatively harmless," she cut him off. "It stimulates the heart a bit, but Zenithra's heart is strong. I can hear it beating half a continent away. We need to know what happened right now, and Oret is the fastest way."
Thuddy had opened his red leather case, and he handed Polgara one of his little vials. She judiciously tapped 3 drops of the yellow liquid into a cup, and then filled the cup with water.
"Zenithra, dear,"
she said to the little queen,
"you must be thirsty. This might help."
She handed the cup to the red-haired girl.
"We thank you, Lady Polgara."
Zenedra drank deeply.
"As a matter of fact, I was just about to ask someone for a drink of water."
"Very smooth, Paul," Belden whispered.
"Rudimentary, uncle."
"Do you have any idea of what they are talking about?"
Zakath asked Geryon.
Aunt Paul implanted the notion of thirst into Zenedra's mind.
"You people can actually do that?"
"As she said, it's rudimentary."
"Can you do it?"
"I don't know. I've never tried."
Geryon's attention was, however, firmly fixed on his blissfully smiling little wife. Polgara calmly waited.
"I think you can begin now, Lady Polgara," Tzadi said after a few minutes.
"Tzadi," she said absently, "we know each other well enough by now to skip the formalities. I am not going to choke over your excellency, so why should you strangle on my lady
Why, thank you, Polgara. Now, Senedra, Polgara said.
Yes, Aunt Paul?
The tiny queen said, her eyes slightly unfocused.
Oh, there's a first, Silk said to Belden.
She's been living with Geryon for quite a while now, the dwarf replied. Things do rub off after a bit.
I wonder what Polgara would do if I called her by that name.
I don't recommend experimentation, Belden told him. It's up to you, though, and you'd make a very interesting-looking radish.
Zenedra, Polgara said, why don't you tell me exactly how you got your baby back?
Harold found him for me,
Zenedra smiled.
Now I have even more reason to love Errol.
We all love Errol.
Isn't he beautiful?
Zenedra turned back the blanket to reveal her rags. He's lovely, dear. Did you and Errol have a chance to talk at all?
Oh, yes, Aunt Paul. She is doing something that's very important. That's why she could not join us just now. She said she might be able to catch up with us at Berevor, or maybe later at Corum.
Then she knew where we are going?
Oh, no, Aunt Paul,
Zenedra laughed.
I had to tell her. She does so want to be with us, but she has this important thing to do. She asked me where we are going, and I told her about Perivor and Corim. She seemed a little surprised about Corim, though.
Aunt Paul's eyes narrowed.
I see, she said. Durnick, why don't you set up a tent? I think Zenedra and her baby should get a little rest.
Right away, Paul, her husband agreed, after a quick look at her.
Now that you mention it, Aunt Paul,
Zenedra said happily,
I do feel a little tired. And I'm sure Geryon needs a nap. Baby sleeps so much, you know. I'll nurse him, and then he'll sleep. He always sleeps after he nurses.
Steady, Zakath said quietly to Geryon, as the Raven King's eyes filled with tears.
The Malorian Emperor put his hand firmly on his friend's shoulder.
What's going to happen when she wakes up, though?
Polgara can fix it.
After Durnick had set up the tent, Polgara led the bemused girl inside. After a moment, Geryon felt a slight surge and heard a whisper of sound. Then his aunt came out of the tent carrying Zenedra's bundle. Get rid of this, she said, pushing it into Geryon's hands.
Is she going to be all right?
He asked her. She is asleep now. She will wake up in about an hour. And when she does, she won't remember that any of this happened. None of us will mention it to her, and that will be the end of it.
Geryon took the bundle back into the woods and hid it under a bush. When he returned, he approached Taradas.
It was Zandramas, wasn't it? He demanded.
Yes,
Taradas replied simply.
And you knew it was going to happen, didn't you?
Yes.
Why didn't you warn us?
To have done so would have been an interference in an event that had to occur.
That was cruel, Taradas.
Necessary events sometimes are. I tell thee, Belgerian, Zandramas could not go to Kel as thou didst. Therefore, she had to find the location of the meeting from one of thy companions, else she would not be at the place which is no more at the proper time.
Why, Zenedra?
Zandramas, thou wilt recall, hath imposed her will upon the queen in times past. It is not difficult for her to reimpose that bond.
I'm not going to forgive this, Saradis.
Geryon, Zakath said, let it go. Zenedra has not been hurt, and Saradis was only doing what she had to do.
The Malorian seemed peculiarly defensive. Geryon turned and stalked away, his face livid with anger. When Zenedra awoke, she appeared to have no memory of the meeting in the woods and seemed to have returned to normal. Durnick struck the tent, and they rode on. They reached the edge of the forest about sunset and set up for the night there. Geryon rather studiously avoided Zakath, not trusting himself to be civil to his friend after he had jumped to the defense of the blindfolded Seeress. Zakath and Serathus had engaged in a lengthy conversation before they had all left Kel, and now the Emperor seemed wholly committed to her cause. His eyes were sometimes troubled, though, and he frequently turned in his saddle to look at her. That night, however, when they were both on watch, it was no longer possible for Geryon to avoid his friend.
"Are you still angry with me, Geryon?" Zakath asked.
Geryon sighed.
"No, I guess not. I don't think I was really angry. Just a little irritated is all. Most of all, I'm angry with Xandramas, not with you and Serathus. I don't like people who play tricks on my wife."
"It really had to happen, you know. Xandramas had to find out where the meeting is going to take place. She has to be there, too."
"You're probably right. Did Serathus give you any details about your task?"
"A few. I am not supposed to talk about it, though. About all I can tell you is that somebody very important is coming, and I am supposed to help him."
"And that's going to take you the rest of your life?"
"And probably the lives of a lot of others as well."
"Mine too?"
"I don't think so. I think your task will be over after the meeting. Serathus sort of implied that you have done enough already."
They set out early that morning and rode out onto a rolling plain along the west side of the Balaza River. There were farm villages here and there, villages that looked rude, but in which the houses were really very well constructed. The Dalesian villagers labored in the fields with the simplest of tools.
"And it is all subterfuge," Zakath said wryly. "These people are probably far more sophisticated than even the Malsines, and they have gone to a great deal of trouble to hide the fact."
"Would thy people or the priests of Torak have left them unmolested, had the truth been known?"
Serathus asked him.
"Probably not," he admitted. "The Malsines in particular would likely have pressed most of the Dals into service in the bureaucracy."
"That would not have been compatible with our tasks."
"I understand that now. When I get back to Malzeth, I think I will make some changes in imperial policy toward the Dalesian protectorates. Your people are doing something much, much more important than raising beets and turnips for the rest of Meloria."
"If all goes well, our work will be done once the meeting hath taken place, Emperor Zakath."
"But your studies will continue, won't they?"
She smiled.
"Inevitably. The habits of eons die very hard."
Belgarath pulled his horse in beside Serathus.
"Could you be a bit more specific about what we are supposed to be looking for when we get to Perivor?" he asked her.
"It is as I have told thee at Kel, ancient Belgarath. At Perivor thou must seek out the map that will guide thee to the place which is no more."
"How is it that the people of Perivor know more about it than the rest of the world?"
She did not reply.
"I gather that this is another one of those things you are not going to tell me."
"I may not at this time, Belgarath."
Belden came soaring in.
"You'd better get ready. There's a patrol of Darshevan soldiers just ahead."
"How many?" Geryon asked quickly.
"A dozen or so. They've got a Grolem with them. I didn't want to get too close, but I think it's White Eyes. They're hiding in ambush in a grove of trees in the next valley."
"How would he know we were coming this way?"
Velvet asked in perplexity.
Zandravas knows that we are going to Perivore, Bulgara replied. This is the shortest route.
A dozen Dashivans do not really pose much of a threat, Zakath said confidently. What is the purpose of this, then?
Delay, Belgaroth told him.
Zandravas wants to hold us up, so that she can get to Perivore before we do. She can communicate with Naradus over long distances. We can probably expect him to set traps for us every few miles, all the way to Lenga.
Zakath scratched at his short beard, frowning in concentration. Then he opened one of his saddlebags, took out a map, and consulted it.
We are still about 15 leagues from Lenga, he said.
He squinted at Belden.
How fast can you cover that distance?
A couple of hours. Why?
There is an Imperial garrison there. I will give you a message to the garrison commander with my seal on it. He will move out with troops and spring those traps from behind. As soon as we join those forces, Naradus won't be bothering us anymore.
And then he remembered something.
Olisires, he said to Seradus, back in Dashiva, you told me to leave my troops behind when I came to Kel. Is that prohibition still in effect?
Nay, Kalzakath.
Good. I will write that message.
What about the patrol hiding just ahead? Silk asked Geryon. Or are we just going to wait here until Zakath's troops arrive?
I don't think so. What's your feeling about a little exercise?
Silk's answering grin was vicious.
There is still a problem, though, Velvet said. With Belden on his way to Lenga, we won't have anyone to scout out any other ambushes.
Tell the she with yellow hair not to be concerned,
the wolf said to Geryon.
One is able to move without being seen, or if one is seen, the man things will pay no heed.
It's all right, Lysel, Geryon said. The wolf will scout for us.
She's a very useful person to have along,
Velvet smiled.
Person, Silk said.
Well, isn't she?
He frowned.
You know, it might be right at that. She has a definite personality, doesn't she?
The wolf wagged her tail at him, then loped off. All right, gentlemen, Geryon said, loosening Iron Grip's sword in its sheath. Let's go pay these lurking Darshivans a visit.
Won't Naradus cause us some problems?
Zakath asked, handing his note to Belden.
I certainly hope he tries, Geryon replied.
Naradus, however, proved to no longer be among the Darshivan soldiers hidden in the grove of trees. The skirmish was short, since most of the ambushers seemed to be much better at running than at fighting.
Amateurs,
Zakath said scornfully, wiping his sword blade on the cloak of one of the fallen.
You are getting fairly competent with that, you know,
Geryon complimented him.
The training I was given when I was young seems to be coming back,
Zakath replied modestly.
He handles that sword almost the same way Hetar handles his saber, doesn't he?
Silk noted, pulling one of his daggers out of a Darshivan's chest.
Much the same, Geryon agreed. And Hetar got his training from Kohag, the finest swordsman in Algaria.
Which Tar Urgus discovered the hard way, Silk added. I would have given a great deal to watch that fight,
Zakath said wistfully.
So would I, Geryon said. But I was busy somewhere else at the time.
Sneaking up on Torak,
Zakath suggested.
I don't think sneaking is the right word. He knew I was coming.
I'll go get the ladies in Belgarath, Durnik said.
Belden spoke with me, Belgarath told them when he rode up. Naradus flew out of this grove before you got here. Belden considered killing him, but he had that parchment in his talons.
What form did he take? Silk asked. Naradus, I mean.
A raven, Belgaroth said with distaste. Golems are always fond of ravens, for some reason.
Silk suddenly laughed.
Remember the time when Asherak the Murgo changed into a raven on the plain of Arindia, and Polgra called that eagle down to deal with him. It rained black feathers for almost an hour.
Who is Asherak the Murgo? Sakath asked.
He was one of Tuchik's underlings, Belgarath replied.
Did the eagle kill him?
No, Silk said. Geryon did that later.
With his sword,